Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. We'll look at the front pages first. You're not going to believe this, right? They're literally in the Irish Mail on Sunday. They're literally arguing now over who shook hands with who at the so-called gentleman's agreement. And of course, we know it was very much a gentleman's agreement rather than a ladies and gentlemen agreement. So it's down to a handshake agreement shot down by SF Labour, because they say, well, we didn't shake hands with the people you're saying we shook hands with, and everyone's arguing over who shook hands with who. It's extraordinary. The Sunday Independent: we can do business with Trump, says Harris. Mr. Harris will set up a trade consultative forum, which will meet once a month and focus on promoting Irish trade during Mr. Trump's second term in the White House, which could sound a bit like bringing a knife to a gunfight. There are also scenes of devastation, weather-related devastation, still on the front pages today. And the story on the front page of the Sunday Independent: it's a bit of a miracle, my snoring saved her life. So a woman who left her bed because her husband was snoring, and she turned out to be very glad that she left her bed. The Sunday Times: coalition creates junior ministry to tackle migration. Fine Gael will take up new brief and departmental shake-up. So presumably this will be under Jim O'Callaghan, the Minister for Justice's department. Roderick O'Gorman says that the fact that the integration brief is now being downgraded. They also have an off-lead on the front of the Sunday Times: Britain claims first dibs on Greenland if Denmark bows to demands from President Trump to sell Greenland, which by the sounds of the phone call the other day, they're not going to. It would give Britain first refusal under a pact made in 1917, the last Danish minister for the Arctic Island said yesterday. This is like stuff, I don't know, it's like guys sitting around in the Explorers Club in the 19th century or something, divvying up things. The Business Post: Donoghue seeks third Eurogroup term as trade offensive ramps up. And they also have a poll. And the Sunday World has a shocking video showing a gunman threatening to kill a convicted drug dealer after a horror abduction. And then the Sunday Mirror: Power Rangers, army drafted in to help ESB restore electricity as big cleanup begins. And I suppose, look, if you're without power, this is no good to you. And if you're down the list for being reconnected, this is no good to you. But it is notable that when this was printed sometime last night, there were 400,000 households and businesses and right without power. And right now, as we just heard on the news, it's 340. But as I say, what they say is they take the low-hanging fruit first. Whichever reconnection will bring back the most people. So if you're down that list in a more remote or rural area, you could be waiting, and that's not a pleasant wait. We'll come back to the weather, of course, over the course of the next hour. But first, let's meet our panel today. David W. Higgins is an economist. Professor Niamh Horrigan is Vice President of Academic Affairs at Mary Immaculate College and Labour candidate in the recent European elections. Finian McGrath is a former independent TD and a former Minister of State for Disability Issues. And Alison O'Connor is a columnist with the Sunday Times. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning,
Brendan. Finian, the goings-on in the Dáil during the week are not going away. You picked that piece on the Mail on Sunday by John Lee: Dáil chaos, handshake agreement shot down by SF Labour. And this is reference to the point that at one stage, a lot of people seem to have thought there was an agreement, and then people came out and there were all these conversations and everything, and suddenly uproar again. So you, of course, are the, will we call you the political mentor of Barry Heenan, who was one of the technical group in question. Did he give you any insight on what was going on?
Well, actually, just to give you a bit of context, I was in the Dáil on Tuesday and I was going in to meet Barry Heenan and some of our team. And then we adjourned to the Dáil bar for our lunch, and we met Boxer Borden and we had lunch with Boxer. At that stage, there was a great positive buzz around the place. They were all very giddy, actually.
Oh, yeah, because Boxer and them thought that they were going to get away with the stroke at that
point. Well, no, not that. No, that's not true, Brendan. But basically, and while we're there, There was I was talking to a lot of Labour people, Sinn Féin people as well as our own group. And I even met the Can Corla very briefly as well. And everything seemed to be very calm on Tuesday and thing. They all knew that they presumed at that stage that the talk and rights issues would be resolved and it had to be sorted. And I was saying to them at the time we were having the chat was, stick with the programme for government. We need to get rid of that landmine of using the and use government speaking time. And if needs be, get extra time from government speaking time to resolve the.
This is
on Tuesday now.
Yeah. Did you say you were saying that or that was there general agreement?
We're discussing with Boxer and Barry.
Yeah. Right. So the technical group was in agreement at that point that they would not get away with being with the rest of them, the rump of them being in the opposition.
They knew it had to be resolved.
And they knew it had to be resolved by them in some way.
But they were presuming it was going to be resolved by the committee and the amendment 170 had to be dealt with because that was there in the past. Now, I firmly believe, by the way, that the legal advice that Ken Corla got on the old standing order 170 was correct. That's my personal position.
So am I right in that the reasoning they were giving was that the standing orders as they stood, so to speak, technically it was correct that the group would be in opposition, but there needed to be new standing orders. And the argument was, in order to make new standing orders, you needed a new government to be formed.
Correct. And then you kick it into the Reform Committee and they deal with the issue and come up with the new amendment. And a lot of us thought on Tuesday that this was going to happen. But just to get back to your point there about John Lee's great story on the front page of the Mail on Sunday about and the Dáil chaos and the handshake agreement shot down. Like, I would know Peter Finnegan now for a long time. I knew Peter before he became clerk of the Dáil. I know him for 20 years, long before he got the big job. And can I say, he's a great public servant. He has solid integrity. He's a very fair person, balanced person. And I do believe that they shook hands and made a degree.
Okay.
And I do believe
that two groups... Sinn Féin says that happened, that everyone shook hands with the clerk of the Dáil.
I don't buy that whatsoever. And my sources tell me that they shook hands and they left that room. They said they were going to kick it into the proposal that I said the day before, kick it into the Reform Committee, look at the Amendment 170 and try and facilitate the opposition. And also, more importantly, Brendan, is protect the speaking rights of the independent TDs. So firmly believe that they changed their minds. And the bottom line is they welched on the deal. And I don't...
I think that's your take on it.
I think it's...
Alison, would you buy Finian's rather kind of, I don't know, jolly hockey sticks version of this story that it was all going to be fine and that the government were going to sort this out and accept the remaining members of the technical group into the government umbrella effectively on speaking time?
Listening to Finian and saving his presence, I found myself wondering, if you're high on the hog, does it mean you fail to read the room? I mean, you didn't have to be following politics too closely to see the trouble that was coming down the track. And I was writing about this myself today in the Sunday Times in terms of the context of all of this going right back to Verona Murphy being elected and TDs being instructed to vote for her and her thanking Michael Lowry, you know, all the way through to what happened.
Does it actually start one step further back than that?
Michael Lowry on television on the night of the election, basically saying, come for me. I'm here for you. And Claire Scott has a very good piece in the Sunday Times where she starts quoting an unnamed member of the regional independent TD saying we should have made a move on things before Wednesday, meaning, you know, allowing Michael Lowry out as the leader, that they should have moved that on or moved him out of the limelight. Now, that would be easier said than done. And that
she seems to say they didn't expect Lowry to court the limelight as much.
It's just like, what? And also, you know, Michael Lowry's judgment, you know, where were they with that and thinking how all that would work out? Claire is saying that Micheál Martin and Simon Harris sorely underestimated Lowry's desire for the limelight. And I mean, these are, particularly in the case of Micheál Martin and particularly in the case of Fianna Fáil's history, that Micheál Martin has worked so hard to distance himself and the party from. It was a case of, you know, you were almost looking at times thinking, is there some sort of a mask slipping here? And like there were others who, I mean, Shane Coleman in the Business Post this morning would say, yes, it was stroke politics, but agreed with Micheál Martin basically saying it was subverting the constitution. But I mean, I would say we weren't talking about Capitol Hill, you know, it maybe went a bit too far. I don't think the opposition set out for it to go that far, but they smelt blood. And I think it was a touch of sloppiness and amateur night on the part of the government. I'll end on this point. Yeah. Leo Varadkar is also saying today in the Times, he's written a piece. It's just he's saying that in other parliaments, because this row is all about speaking time and where do Michael Lowry and the remaining TDs get their speaking time? And he's saying in other parliaments, the groups of the ruling parties are allowed to have a separate identity from the government and their own dedicated time. Like, times have changed politically. There's a lot more independence. There's a lot more smaller parties. It is time that changed. But to be fair to the opposition parties and the way they continued what they did on Wednesday, they have no trust. This was their moment to strike. That if they let that moment go, where's their trust in the government? Because to finally say, as Shane Ross says this morning, it's now gone to a dull committee, as he describes it, the traditional cul-de-sac for political hot potatoes.
Okay, but this cul-de-sac will have to be sorted. It hasn't disappeared.
And for me, the key word that was resonating in my mind all week was stability. Because these are two government parties who ran an entire election campaign on the basis of, by voting for us, we will deliver stability. We're going to bring back stability. And what happened was that they, in, I think, really a clear mistake, made a choice between the stability of the government and the stability of the system. They took the stability of the system for granted. And I think the first hint that we had that was coming down the tracks was when Verona Murphy was made Count Corla. Because I think, I wish Verona Murphy well and I hope she does well in the role. But the role of Count Corla involves a very particular skill set. It is as much pastoral as it is political. Seán Fáil did a huge amount of work in the background with everybody across the House, getting people to march to a certain line, keeping the show on the road. The Count Corla is the upholder of the rules. And I think the reason why part of the lack of trust that emerged this week was because of the decision that the Count Corla had already made. I think if she had made that call to bounce it into the committee before this ever emerged, then it would have been different.
Okay, David, I'll come to you in a minute, but I just want to let Finney come back on that. Verona Murphy had legal advice that this was the way to proceed.
Yes, but Brendan, you cannot be in the opposition and government at the same time. That's not how democracy works in Ireland. That's how democracy works in Belarus.
Can I just make three solid points, David? Regardless of what you think of the issue, listen, of course, I think the opposition have legitimate concerns and that can be fixed, and it was about to be fixed. But the big issue for me was, and really and I, was the chaotic scenes in Ardal, the way it damaged the integrity of Ardal. It was the opposition who were heckling and bullying and shouting and roaring across the chamber. And I thought it was disgraceful bullying, by the way, of the Count Corla. And the political posturing that went on was totally political. And the bottom line is, and it even seems to be here this morning, do people accept the results of the elections? The vote in the Dáil was 90 votes.
Do you accept
votes,
democracy?
95,
I suppose that's the other issue, Finian.
Democracy is 95
democracy
votes to 76.
Is the underpinning of the election results.
Oh dear,
and you have to accept that democracy is the first principle and then the formation of the government is the second principle.
But the democratic,
and that was the sight that was lost this week, and particularly...
And what was that?
Lost
what was
by Micheál Martin.
I'll come back to you.
What was anti-democratic?
What is anti-democratic is that you can't be in government and opposition at the same time, Brendan. Full stop.
Okay, David Higgins.
I think it's important to remember what's the counterfactual here. What would have been different had we allowed this technical group or not? Leaders' questions, take it for example. It's still going to be Sinn Féin goes first. It's still then going to be Labour and Sóc Dem put their questions to the government. Then it'll be the left technical group. Then we'll get down. We're talking about the fine detail at the end of debates in the Dáil, because the order is always going to be the largest first.
But are we talking about a principle, as Niamh says, a principle of democracy?
No, in fact, I'd bring in the example of the UK. When Prime Minister's questions happens in the UK, yes, you'll have the leaders of the opposition go first.
This is really important because
in the UK you'll have members of the government party, but also have the right to question the Prime Minister. Yeah. And that'll be awkward for that Prime Minister. It's coming from their own party, let alone an independent group that might be supporting a government. I think you should be allowed
government
to have a second
ministers in Ireland group. Have always held government to account. I mean, look at Anne Rabbitt and the last government on disability. I mean, she was continually calling out her own people.
The fine line between government and opposition has been a principle here for a long time. I'll just say at this point, for people's illumination,
that David, you are a member of Fine Gael.
Yes.
Okay, Alison next and then Finian. Alison, can I ask you a question? Finian mentioned there the bullying of Verona Murphy. And Verona Murphy's Verona Murphy's name has come up a bit. There were probably three different theses on it. One was that her inexperience and maybe temperament, or the temperament we thought she had, maybe even that she wasn't kind of assertive enough in the way we expected she might be, and she was inexperienced. One was, as Finian has articulated there, that it was bullying. And then there have been charges of sexism as well. So which was it?
I think that there are a number of factors here. I think that it started with how, as I mentioned earlier, it started with how she was elected to the position and how she thanked Michael Lowry. It's the fact that she's a one-term TD. In other words, I think when you're going for the County Corliss position, you benefit from serving a number of terms and knowing Parliament and how it works very well. I think it's that under any other circumstance, Verona Murphy would have been one throwing oil on the fire. This is a totally new position for her. She would have been the chief pot stirrer in times past. She was also in a very invidious position that she came from the regional independent group, and the concern being then that if she showed favouritism towards them. So roaring people down is never good. There's been, there's a lot of talk in the papers about how it started with Matt Carthy, Sinn Féin. But I also think, so there's no easy answer to this, as you can tell from how long it's taken me to give it to you. But I also think that she could have been a bit more sure-footed. And I think that what happened was that this wasn't, even though Micheál Martin believed that this was planned by the opposition, from start to finish, particularly Sinn Féin.
He's right.
I don't think that. I don't believe that. I think that they smelt blood and the momentum built.
Murphy's blood as much as they
as much as everything else. Blood. Because you then, as time went on, you had that position of like, what happens then? If the opposition were to say to Verona Murphy, we don't have confidence in you, that would make her position untenable.
Has she survived, Niamh?
I just wanted to make one final point, sentence. Yeah. During all of this, I was brought back in this idea that the public couldn't give a toss about who speaks when in Leinster House and all of that. I was remembering back to during COVID times, and Pete Lunn, professor at the ESRI, I'm sure, in this very studio, his research would say that, with new restrictions and how people felt about them and all of that and decisions taken by the government. And he would say that people would basically feel that if those restrictions were fair and fairly implemented, people were OK with it. So I think that people would see very clearly and very easily that this was unfair. It was a stroke to try and say that these people should speak, take up opposition time.
I think Verona has survived. I personally think that she has a massive professional journey to go on to hold that Ceann Comhairle position in an even-handed manner. I think she can do it. I mean, I think it's possible for anybody to do it. But it is a long way from where she has positioned herself on the political spectrum. And historically, the kinds of people who've done this role and been really successful have been the steady Eddies and steady Edwinas, who are on good terms with people across the house, share a lot of respect. And that's not to say that Verona Murphy isn't respected, but her historical manner of being a politician has been quite provocative. And therefore, you're into a completely different skill set here. And I wish her well, but I hope she realises the mountain she has to climb.
Is your man Barry Heenahan happy to now seemingly be represented by Michael Lowry? There were a few people involved in the negotiations, but yeah. Michael Lowry seems to become the de facto figurehead.
Well, that's
Barry Heenahan's
the line that you're. But so did Marion Harkin and Sean Kenny. were part of the delegation.
Oh, I know, So is Barry Heenan happy about this, that he is now associated with Michael Lowry
Barry Heenan is an independent for Dublin Bay and North. He's focused on his own constituents' issues and national issues, and he's made fantastic submissions to the programme for government, and it's all his fingerprints are all over it. That's the first thing. Second thing is Barry Heenan would support the Moriarty Tribunal findings and McCracken as well.
I think
so there's no issue.
That's not
there.
What he said on Ireland AM.
Really?
No, he was critical of the costs of the tribunal. He was critical of the
He would support the findings. So I go back again.
Absolutely,
So is he happy? Is he happy for Michael Lowry to be the de facto now, and as far as the public is concerned, leader of his grouping in the
Barry Heenan,
and for Michael Lowry to be fighting his
battles? You see, you don't understand the procedures even of the technical group term. They're not a political party like Labour or Sinn Féin or Fianna Fáil. They're a group of independents that got together, agreed a programme for government, two major parties, right? But Barry Heenan is his own person. He's representing the people of Dublin.
But it still matters for him who they put out in front to speak for them.
Yeah, Marion
and the
Harkin
person
and
that
Sean
they've
Kenny.
Chosen to put out in front more than anyone else since
Marion
the night
Harkin,
of the election is Michael Lowry.
Yeah.
And that's a choice.
We haven't heard from Marion Harkin and
well, she's very busy now settling into her.
Well, aren't they all learning now? They all learning now? You play with the Lowry fire, you get burnt.
Alison,
I mean,
did
you
hear
have to
as
be
well
too
that
mature in politics to
was
know
the
that.
Reality of what was going on at one point was that if Michael Lowry had backed down himself on speaking time, that things could have moved on, and that Michael Lowry was refusing to do that. Is that not what we were being told?
Yeah, I mean, you could see on Wednesday. I mean, Michael Lowry was cock of the walk the whole way through. You know, having conversations with bunches of journalists on the plinth, and the government looking on in some dismay while this continued. Mm. But that's what happens. I mean, if you're like, you don't need to. There was a lot of talk in the last few weeks about how Micheál Martin, being a long time on the road, could sort of see around corners, looking at political problems. And I mean, and to be fair, it's Michael Lowry came from Fine Gael, and is the one that sort of really messed with that party's squeaky clean image in terms of the Moriarty Tribunal. So to my mind, the government basically was handed its arse this week by what happened.
By taking their eye off the ball and dealing with Michael Lowry.
And Finian,
you've had a good all-outing
They can't have it everywhere, Finian.
You're distracting from the main thing that happened at all. I was in opposition and I remember being thrown out once I worked under four different Cancorlas, right? I remember being thrown out once. No way would I have treated any Cancorla like the way the Cancorla was
treated. Do you think, though, Finian, they would have pulled this stroke in 2020?
People should accept that.
Just to finish up on this, because I don't think that we have discussed enough the kind of tone of the carry-on and how people watch it. You pick Shane Coleman's piece, Ugly Tactics from the Trump Playbook Cannot Be a Template for the 34th Dáil. Because I think a lot of people did think, the whole lot of them, this is disgraceful.
Yes, I completely agree. I mean, Coleman hits the nail on the head. He said, Trump-style politics came to Dáil Éireann last week, bringing with it bile, ugliness, divisiveness and a complete lack of respect for political opponents. Only lasted one day, but it has set a dangerous precedent for what is now deemed acceptable in Irish politics.
So now Was it ugly?
Trump-style politics.
You see, I think this is the critical point, and I actually think this link is really interesting, because if you look at the gene pool here of the regional independents, and I'm talking particularly about Michael Lowry and Verona Murphy and some of the other characters, there are ideological links to the kind of climate scepticism and positions on migration that we have seen
I think they would disagree with that characterisation.
But the nature of populists is to test the rules, and that's what Michael Lowry did here. And he didn't get away with it, but that's a classic move. And what you get when you come out of that is chaos.
It's a political hatchet of an independent candidate, so that's what's going on as well.
And okay, we have real problems in the country. And David, the Mail on Sunday today, Valerie Hanley is writing about planning reform delay threatens pledge to build 300,000 homes, and this is about the new planning bill that has been talked about ad nauseum. And is 800 pages and all this, but it's going to take 2 years to happen.
Yeah, this stood out as with concern to me. I mean, James Brown is the new minister who's coming in. He was swapping out from Dara O'Brien, and a key thing for him to do is get supply going? Because we've seen that the number of homes built last year was actually down 6.7% on 2023. And it looks like the new planning bill, now an act, which has been implemented, might take 18 to 24 months before it is fully implemented. Now, it seems to be that there's partial enactment now that it is enacted, but that there will be effectively extra regulations that need to be written around it, effectively kind of maybe translating it for people in the planning system. There's the establishment of Van Commissioen Plan Alle, which could take 18 to 24 months. And I see a risk here that if developers are looking in at this system and they're going to make a call, well, could we get our stuff more likely passed before that time or after? That could be a challenge.
And then a lot of people will say that they've come up with a huge planning bill to kind of, it's almost like when the railroads came in, the Pony Express going, we need to find a faster pony. They've got this planning bill, which is better ways of doing what we're currently doing. Instead of like, there's no new big idea or anything, or no change in the game.
Well, the idea with it is that you'll be able to facilitate a faster system of more development coming through. What is notable, though, is that the decline in house building that we've seen in last year really is a story that you go back to 2022, because it takes about 2 years to build a house. And that's where you had interest rates go up. A lot of developers kind of stood back and said, right, guys, our costs have gone up big time, so we're not going to develop. But actually, what you have seen in the year since is that has picked up a bit more. So the pipeline for the next 2 years probably will continue to rise from here. The question might be the later half of this Dáil term, 300,000 homes being the target over the 5 years. We may get back towards target in the early part, but the second half of this Dáil term could be open question.
Yeah, are we going to build 300,000 houses in the next 5 years?
I think one of the problems that has bedeviled the housing issue in Ireland in the last couple of years is trying to invoke change that doesn't actually slow things down. We've seen this with the LDA, where you've seen the LDA take big sites in cities in particular, where Limerick is a case in point, where there's an extreme housing shortage. The LDAs come in and take sites off the council, and then because of their own shortages will not be able to turn a sod on those sites for 5 years when the council is staffed up already in terms of our engineers and architects. But the second piece, and I think this is the bigger issue, and I know people like Michelle Norris were talking about this week, is the disappointment that the bigger ideas, the bigger flaw in how we're approaching housing, which was indicated and highlighted for the Housing Commission, was not reflected anywhere in the programme for government. And so effectively we're still talking about doing the same thing, still relying on the market, still not interfering in the market when the market has failed to solve the problem.
Okay, well, I think there's a certain amount of interference in the market, and people have differences as to how well that is working. By the way, we forgot to we got carried away with the row there, and we forgot to talk about another big talking point, and I think what other people would say was a kind of a hiccup in the government formation. Alison, you picked Josepha Madigan's piece in the Sunday Indo today, "Women's Voices Need to Be Heard at the Highest Level of Politics." It was the mention of James Brown there made me think of it, because, of course, we have many Jameses in the
indeed, that we have as many Jameses as we have women in the cabinet. I mean, what to say, Brendan, about this? And I mean, I found myself thinking over the weekend, you know, I wonder how much thought, because it's Micheál Martin in this particular instance that has one female less in his cabinet picks, despite, if you like, having, you know, having more room for choice. And I found myself thinking, I wondered how much thought this cost him. Did it bother him that much? And you'd have to conclude, it's supposition on my part, not that much, because he hasn't really done that much for women in Fianna Fáil. Yes, I will always give him that in the abortion referendum in 2018.
What hasn't he done?
Well, what has he done? You know, name me one single thing that he has done. What all you see is, and I mean, they're all guilty of this, and I'd love to see it drummed out, that, you know, you donut the few women you have around the leader when they're to make the leader look better when there's a photograph. But apart from that, done absolutely SFA in terms of promoting women.
What should he have done that he hasn't done?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no, first of all, I suppose, pick candidates that, you know, that have a good chance of winning seats. But let's not dwell on the past, right? Micheál Martin now is probably in his last lap. We've been saying that for quite a while. But let him do something like make sure that there are quotas for local elections, because that's the way you build up the pipeline.
The pipeline. pipeline.
The pipeline. Women for
Elections.
And
I'm sure Fianna Fáil would argue that they have a pipeline coming through.
Well, it's not a very, it's not a very good
and
one.
And I presume women we'll see plenty of women made junior ministers
made junior ministers. But I mean, the Mail on Sunday, and this is when you join the you join the dots for me. Valerie Hanley and John Donnelly, there's a piece today, it's Natasha O'Brien, the Limerick, that really impressive woman, and she's making the point, half of our nation are women, so why are so few in cabinet? And she talks about her interactions with, she's saying, you know, of course, that she's, you know, there were some very good male TDs, but the extra understanding that she got from female politicians and the empathy and the desire to do something. So it's not that there shouldn't be, you know, of course, men have a role to play without a doubt, but it's the absolute imbalance and this notion that we're going backwards and this notion of what we see going on in the United States with Donald Trump and all of that and how anti-women that is and that we're not even making any bit of an effort to
I presume anyone trying to put together a government would say that they need to pick the best people to run the country regardless of gender.
I think they would, but I think when you already had such a small number of women in cabinet, to go down is unfortunate to say the least. I do think for Fianna Fáil in particular, and this is an issue I think that Micheál Martin should be looking at, there is a question as to how the local party infrastructure in Fianna Fáil actually supports their female candidates, because certainly we saw, you know, Fianna Fáil had to adhere to the quota like everybody else. But I mean, certainly in Limerick during the general election, and I think in parts of Galway, you know, there were female candidates, I think, questioning how much support they actually got from the local Fianna Fáil infrastructure. And I think that's something that you can't send out a message around.
Any candidate who doesn't do well usually blames.
Yeah, but some, I think, have more legitimacy to their gripes than others.
Okay. Well, sorry, Brian, I think Niamh has a strong point there in relation to, I think it's right down to the reform of the political parties at grassroots level. I think there's an issue there. But can I say, go back to the points made earlier on about Alison. First of all, I heard the figure three, only three in cabinet. There's actually five women in the cabinet. There's two super junior ministers. And there's a little bit of intellectual snobbery coming across in some political circles about this, that they're only a super junior. I was a super junior minister for 4.5 years. I was treated around the cabinet table every Tuesday morning the exact same way as every other single
and
minister.
And there was never a vote.
Yeah. And lots of times, myself and Shane Ross would have loads of rows, and it'd be 16-2 at lots of the rows. But we'd accept the democratic wishes of our colleagues, which the other day in the Dáil, some people in the Dáil did not accept the result of the general election, which was 93.
Okay, yeah, we got that point. Okay,
95-70.
Yeah, David. I think the measure of this should be how women fare over the next 5 years. If each of the ministers go off, if it's housing, James Brown goes off and build more houses, that's going to benefit women and men. If it's going to be healthcare, that's going to benefit women and men. You know, there's many ways you can cut and dice the ministerial ranks. The number of LGBT ministers was down because we lost Radhika Gorman. We still have Jack Chambers. You could cut and dice it by immigrant background. We no longer have Leo Varadkar there. You could do it by left-handed, right-handed. I don't know what.
Oh, look, God spare me from male privilege. No, women make up. Women make up half of the population. I'm not saying you shouldn't have diversity or we shouldn't care about it. Of course we should. But women make up. And you make a good point. Women do need to get off their arses and start voting for other women.
But if they don't, is it right for us to be sitting here and like I've seen it said that the number of women was down by one? We've lost 25% of the women, and the quote I saw online was grim. But we don't know what the next 5 years will hold by policy.
I mean, God bless your optimism. That's all I'll say. And it's easily known when you're of the male gender.
I'm supporting a female candidate in the Shannon, Anne-Marie Flanagan.
All right, stop. You're taking a break. We were having a very highbrow discussion there about a major social issue and you brought cheap local politics into it, Finian. You see, a woman would never have done that now. or would she? Okay, David W. Higgins, Professor Niamh Horrigan, Finian McGrath and Alison O'Connor are staying with us and we'll take a break. Welcome back. Our panel still with us. David W. Higgins, Professor Niamh Horrigan, Finian McGrath and Alison O'Connor. There are texts coming in from around the country, right? Listen to this. How is it possible it would take 2 weeks to restore power where my 83-year-old mother lives? She lives in a rural area and has dementia. We can't believe this. Someone else, spare a thought for those in Abbey Knockmoy area of East Galway. My sister got a text from the ESB this morning to say she will get power due back on February 5th. Niamh, you were looking at this in the Sunday Times by Ian Begley. Power outages in wake of Storm Éowyn expected to last a week.
Yeah, I actually, when I was driving up this morning, I stopped in Portlaoise and there was guys getting out of ESB Networks vans going in for a coffee and they looked absolutely shattered, to be fair to them. I think it's very important to not acknowledge the work of those kind of first responders in this situation. But what is very obviously down south has been hit quite hard, both by the snow and by the storm. And one of the things, interestingly, that's come up is not only the distinction between those who are living in urban and more rural areas, but actually, you know, the planning regulations have changed in recent years and a lot of new houses now don't have any open fire. And if your heating is like solar or geothermal and that needs power to run that system and you don't have any open flame in your house, you're stuck in a rural area. I have a family member in this situation whose small children, no heat, no
ability,
and you can't even put on a fire. And I suppose that was a piece that before these kind of more frequent extreme weather events we hadn't really thought about. But if these start to become more frequent, I think it's going to be very challenging and obviously very worrying for people who have elderly relatives, again, on their own in rural areas. Though those houses are more likely to have open fires and at least that's some sort of heat and you see people do boiling their eggs in the fire and things like that. But it's far from ideal and certainly I think we're seeing people look at like camping stoves and generators and all that we're seeing coming into play very much.
It's going to be hard to, preach the message of electric vehicles and heat pumps and all of that in areas affected by this, because if people are going to begin to say, well, thank God I had a combustion engine car to be able to still get around and get down to the shop. Now, someone made the point in counter to me that if you knew a storm like this was coming, you might charge your EV or you might be able to drive far enough, charge it and then come back.
And there is an argument as well I saw expressed somewhere that EVs would potentially be able to power houses
in reverse.
Going the opposite way, yeah. Because like there is systems, that I don't think it's in Ireland yet, where an EV can
sell power back to
the... You invalidate
your warranty if you hook something up to it at the moment, which is a big problem for people.
Yeah, but there is a plan, I think, that the power from them can be sold back at peak times into the grid, yeah.
I feel for the people who lost their heat and power, etc. My own daughter was affected in Malahide for 24 hours. But I have to kind of prioritise. The one story that really upset me was the story of Casper Dudek, the young 20-year-old
guy. It's desperately sad, isn't it?
When I heard that story, coming home, Casper was 20, lived in Lifford, County Donegal, and I think his boss gave him let him off the night shift a bit early so he'd get home safely. And himself and a friend of his, the friend was behind him. They went in the cavalcade to kind of keep an eye on the trees. Mm. And the tree came down on top and killed a lovely young man. And also an immigrant worker as well. Immigrant family came to Ireland here 10 years ago. And I just think that we often forget about the thousands of people, migrant workers that are in our state that are serving their country and contributing 5 to 7 billion in their taxes every year. We never hear that in the debate. But just to go back to the issue, my heart goes out to the family and I just was devastated for his mother and father and brother and sister. I just thought it was a very tragic story.
Alison, you picked in the Sunday Independent a Niamh Horan piece about a kind of a luckier story. And this came down to, like, Casper just had such freakish bad luck. This is a story of freakish good luck, really.
Absolutely. It's extraordinary. And the headline is, "Maura can no longer complain about my snoring," says husband. This is a piece by Niamh Horan, and it's Neil Robinson and his wife, Maura Adshead, who I'd say has sat in this studio. Mm-hmm. They both work in
Public
University
and
of Liberty.
Politics.
Yeah, and politics. Yeah. And basically on Friday night, and I'm sure there are women all over the world who can, and I did Google this beforehand, men are twice as likely to snore as women, just to, we do seem to have a theme going on this morning, but I checked my facts.
Don't worry, you can say what you want about men here is
so
my rule.
I'm sure Niamh will agree after the week we've had, we need a bit of event. Neil was snoring so loudly that Maura decided she'd had enough and got up and got out of the bed. And with that, this very large tree that they had checked out a couple of years ago, actually a giant beech tree, was more than 100 years old, had been given a clean bill of health. And he was asleep in his own, heard a loud bang, and it was the tree hitting the house. And this whole bunch of debris, including blocks, came through. It missed him by inches and basically fell on the side of the bed that Maura had been on. And he was also drowned in water because of the tank and pipe had burst. So really, an absolutely extraordinary escape. But if I can just say, the other thing that I found very striking, to bring it back to politics, was the moving of Dara O'Brien into transport and looking after transport and environment. Not somebody with a particularly strong record on climate, or who has been known as any sort of a climate champion. And that I think...
Which climate champion from Fianna Fáil would you have put into that role?
Look, can you come back to me in a few days and I might try and have unearthed one.
Because, somebody from the south side run it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think while we'll see the very basics, the things that have to be the climate law, I don't think, you know, I think quite depressingly, and you look
We don't know. Let's go with David Higgins' optimism and see how things pan out over.
I know we have to wait
over
and
the
see
next
what
few
was
years.
The origins of the storm, but even as you're coming in today, we have another storm brewing.
But you know, to be fair, I think there may be certain sectors within the government who would like to see more of a focus on road building, which did get decline during Eamon Ryan's
term. More of a focus on both, I think.
I think ideally on both, but I mean certainly, say where I am, my part of the world, there was huge controversy about not building certain roads which had been promised to people and were readily needed. So
okay, listen, we'll move on because we haven't even mentioned the Trump issue yet, the other big existential threat. David, you picked a piece in the Sunday Indo where Niamh Horan spoke to some economists about the threat of Trump to Ireland.
Yes.
So as an economist, what's your assessment?
So I'll just give you the run of these articles and I'll give you my own assessment. So the Niamh Horan, she's looking at Pascal Lamy first, who is a former Director General of the World Trade Organization. And he makes quite an ambitious pitch to Ireland, which is that Trump negotiates with a gun in his pocket, i.e. he's got something bigger behind him, and that Ireland should try and find our equivalent. I mean, the big thing he mentions is, look, be positive, we're part of a European bloc. That means that all things trade are made together, and that, you know, suddenly 300 million versus a country
but
of five.
Is the rest of Europe going to stand up for our tax policies and fight for something, our economic miracle that they are all very jealous of?
I'm talking about, this is about trade, which regards to the tariff issue.
Yeah, okay,
now, when it comes to corporate tax, truth be told.
We're on our own there.
well, the issue, I think when that issue is most likely to come up is if Trump feels he needs to raise some money. Right now, he's looking to have this department called Department of Government Efficiency actually cut back on spending because he's coming in with that more traditional Republican attitude of a smaller government. But if he finds that his deficit's too wide, if the bond market gets a little jumpy, like it has in the UK, then raising money becomes a problem. Then suddenly the multinationals and getting rid of all those global tax routes that the multinationals can use to route through Ireland, that's when that becomes an issue.
And do we understand yet fully how that might specifically affect us?
What we need to understand is that it's ultimately down to the US Congress to pass laws which will stop the routing of tax via Ireland. It would force American companies to book their profits through America, because what's happening right now is that through US laws, the right is there for those companies to book them through Ireland.
Okay.
That's how we
receive. It sounds very detailed and boring kind of thing.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think will he get that done in the next couple of years, or will there be any rush with that?
I don't think there will be. The immediate focus for Trump seems to be very much on the bigger blocks. So that's China in particular, where he wants more manufacturing at home and doesn't want it to be in China, with the EU, where he perceives that there is an unfairness. But the type of trade you're talking about there will be things like cars, appliances, not necessarily the stuff that we make here in Ireland. It's not to say we'll be completely unscathed by that, but Trump, at least as he comes into office, has more on his agenda stuff that isn't directly related to us to begin with.
Okay, so you're not freaking out yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
But do you not think that Trump is a lot more coherent this time because he has Project 2025, he has the Heritage Foundation, he has a mapped out plan. If you go back to 2016, I mean, one of the big challenges for any American president is they have to appoint this enormous number of staff in the first couple of weeks of being president. And Trump was terrible at that and was too busy flouncing around talking about walls. Whereas now he has a pipeline of people coming through. He has a very clear plan. The 2/3 of the directives he's already implemented are part of Project 2025, and six members of his cabinet are part of the Heritage Foundation. So I actually think, and really I think it's important for people to be aware that what's at the heart of that is a dismantling of the US civil service along the lines of which Viktor Orban did in Hungary and Erdogan did in Turkey. And once that's done, like,
so
that's,
it's an authoritarian,
that's
playbook.
Way more damaging than Brexit. And the question then becomes, in a situation where the kind of power grab that that enables, you essentially politicise so many civil servants appointees, does power ever get handed back?
That's the big question. The person to watch here is going to be a guy called Howard Lutnick. He is Trump's pick for Commerce Secretary, and his confirmation hearing is actually going to begin next week.
And so he'll sail through, seems to be the general.
Yeah, all of them should sail through because there's a majority in the Senate, so that's going to.
But some of them, I think there was a bit more of a worry that people might go rogue on them, but not Lutnick.
Yeah, Lutnick should be fine. He is a big stalwart from the financial sector. He's coming in with decent credentials into the job, but he has mentioned Ireland's tax deals, the corporate tax issue, and he spoke about it somewhat disparagingly. Now, that was in one interview. I went through a 2-hour interview of his where he doesn't mention it at all.
A recent one?
Yeah, a recent one in the past year.
Okay. And that Cantor Fitzgerald connection that he has with Ireland as well, that's him, isn't it?
Yes, that is him.
That's bound to be, like, in real life, that's bound to be something that's going to make him slightly more well-disposed.
You'd hope so. And again, I come back to the thing that the bigger priorities for him is going to be China and getting US manufacturing jobs back home.
Okay.
Not to say rather than China.
You can take it that the government will be kind of on the economic offensive in relation to that. But I also think we should all up our game in relation to the foreign direct investment debate. I think we should be more proactive in places like Asia and the Middle East as well. I think there's more markets out there. But the other issue that I'm very concerned about, Trump, is the issue of the undocumented Irish in America. If he starts throwing those people out now, that's going to be a big problem.
They seem to be fairly far down the list, are they? Like, if they're not being mentioned, it's
They're not on the radar at the moment, but I'd be concerned about them. They say the figure's around 10,000. I heard that figure measured.
But he's got millions of Latino people to get through.
They seem to be further up the hit list, yeah. But also, I mean, when you look at the service industry in the States and America, there's a lot of Latinos working in that sector, and he's going to devastate that. So it's a bit like there's a side of Trump, like I heard him yesterday or a week ago denouncing the WHO and taking their funding. And then this morning I heard in some of Sky News that he might be open to going back in again or something like that. So Trump is a bit like that.
He's open to going back into the World Health Organization.
Sorry, the WHO,
I thought you said the World Trade Organization.
He's a guy that kind of throws out flip flops and does deals. He's saying America had to pay $500 million to the WHO and China are only paying $38 million. I get it down to $38 million. Let's get on with it.
He had a deal,
I was going to say, it's a bit like
Alison, are you freaking out about Trump? Did you freak out about Trump getting in the last time? Are you freaking out the same this time?
Well,
People seem more equanimous, or whatever the word I'm looking for this time.
I have been, on a personal level, trying to kind of mind my own mental health around this. And that after the election, immediately afterwards, like having gone from consuming US media, you know, 24/7 to like for about 6 weeks, nothing, literally nothing. But then thinking, OK, even for work and professional reasons, you know, I have to get back into this. So I do try to limit my exposure. Obviously, this wasn't a good week to be doing that. I think we saw an awful lot of, as Niamh said, he's more organised. We saw an awful lot of heat this week. I think because it's to get off like that, to make his supporters think that I'm going to do all these things that I said I would. But just because he's saying it, we still don't know how everything is going to transpire. But you would fear the worst. But going back to this piece that Niamh Horan had in the Sunday Independent, I mean, I think that Colin McCarthy, the economist who she's quoting, he's saying that I just worry in the current situation that some damn thing is going to go wrong in Ireland. History tells you that once every 10 or 15 years, some effing thing goes arseways. And I mean, you follow that on then to what Matt Cooper's saying in the Business Post. And he's saying if one good thing arises from Donald Trump taking of power, it might be that it removes any sense of complacency from Irish politics and government administration, a belief that the money flow is guaranteed. Now, I don't envy Micheál Martin and Simon Harris, the same as leaders all over the world, wondering how the hell they're going to deal with Trump. But I think we would certainly, yeah. We saw the promises that were made during the general election campaign. We've seen how people are so used to the one-offs in the budget, but now is the time to mind the purse strings.
David, just briefly, as an economist, it's interesting what Colin McCarthy said there, and he's been around a while now. Mm. It's never what you expect, is it? It's always the black swan. Like we're always fighting the last battle, aren't we? Like we're paranoid now about a financial crash around property, but actually it could come from global equity. It'll come from somewhere we're not expecting.
It could be a conflict in the Middle East, and then you can't get the oil out, and then energy prices rise. That's just one scenario. It could be anything. It could be something that Trump himself does not, you know, push the button on or ignite. It could be something that hits him. I mentioned the issue of the US's wide budget deficit. If investors get a bit tetchy on that, you'd see yields rise. Then suddenly he needs to go looking for money, and he might come for the corporate tax.
Are we due a crisis in the world? Given that we really were very lucky to get through, and probably luckier again in Ireland, you could argue that we managed it well. We got through a pandemic, and we got through the war in Ukraine, and we got through an inflation crisis without a major recession.
Yes.
Are we going to keep being lucky, like, or is something due now at this stage?
Nothing good lasts forever. And I know that's very economist, dismal science kind of perspective. But yeah, Colin McCarthy is right here. Something could come up and it could be anything.
Okay, we'll take a break. David W. Higgins, Professor Niamh Horrigan, Finian McGrath and Alison O'Connor staying with us. One other quick text just to give you an insight into what people are going through. I need oxygen and a CPAP machine at night. We've just been told our electricity won't be restored on the 4th of February. We're in Tullagh, County Clare. Surely we deserve better than this. Finian, just briefly before we finish up... Yep. Valerie Hanley in the Mail on Sunday today is talking to Holocaust survivor Tommy Reichenthal tomorrow, the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz-Birkenau, and there will be a very solemn event in Dublin today, but a kind of an unseemly row around it.
Oh yeah, I know there's a row, but just on from Valerie Hanley's excellent article on page 10, she does an interview with the Holocaust survivor Tommy Reichenthal. He's aged 89, and it's a fantastic article. He was aged 9 when he was in the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp in Germany, and Tommy is a victim of anti-Semitism and all the stuff that went on during the Second War, where 6 million Jews were slaughtered. But at the same time, he's very sad about the closure of the Israeli embassy. He is great pals with Michael D. And some people are arguing that they wanted Michael D. at the event today. But Tommy is saying that the president is there, and he wants the president's there, and he wants him to speak to them, because he knows that he'll represent the Irish people, who are not anti-Semitic. They're just anti-war. That's the bottom line.
Okay. Listen, before we go, Niamh, you picked a piece in the Business Post, Ellie Donnelly, about a two-drink limit at Dublin Airport.
Yeah, so two-thirds of people in this survey were in favour of Michael O'Leary's call that there should be a two-drink limit in Dublin Airport, which kind of confirms a lot of other surveys about Ireland kind of falling out of love a bit with alcohol, which is interesting, and I think better from a public safety and public order.
Funnily enough, all that falling out of love with alcohol, and still people will have a breakfast pint when they're going away somewhere in the airport. Okay.
Holiday.
That's it for today. But by the way, I should say, there was on the front of the Business Post there, there's shock about Diageo threatening to sell Guinness. We have a statement in from Diageo. We note the recent media speculation about the Guinness brand and our stake in Moët Hennessy. We can confirm we have no intention to sell either, so rest assured. Thanks very much to my panel, David W. Higgins, economist, Professor Niamh Horrigan, Vice President of Academic Affairs at Mary Immaculate College and a Labour candidate in the recent European elections. Finian McGrath, former Independent TD and former Minister of State for Disability Issues, and Alison O'Connor, columnist with the Sunday Times. Terrific hour, guys. Thank you. And now it's 12 noon and we'll go to the newsroom.